In 1957, the noted photographer W. Eugene Smith moved into a dilapidated five-story loft building at 821 6th Avenue in New York City's Wholesale Flower District. While he worked on a massive photo essay on the city of Pittsburgh, the building served as a late-night haunt of musicians, including some of the biggest names in jazz, like Zoot Sims, who we're listening to right now, Charles Mingus, Roy Haynes, Roland Kirk, Sonny Rollins, Bill Evans, Thelonious Monk, among them, and for countless fascinating underground characters. From 1957 to 1965, Smith exposed 1,447 rolls of film at his loft, making roughly 40,000 pictures, photographing the activities at the Jazz Loft as well as life in the streets below from his fourth floor window. And for the past 13 years, Duke University's Sam Stevenson has researched this story. His book, The Jazz Loft Project, Photographs and Tapes of W. Eugene Smith from 821 6th Avenue, 1957-1965, is published by Knopf. I'm very pleased it has brought Mr. Stevenson to our show today. Hi.
Thanks for having me, Leonard. I appreciate it.
Wasn't Eugene Smith one of the most famous photojournalists of his day?
He was. He was one of Life magazine's classic staff photographers, and he's often referred to today as the master of the photographic essay. He really sort of he became the greatest practitioner of the meditative photographic essay in magazine form.
So what was he doing in this dilapidated building?
Well, he always fought Life's editors over control of his work, artistic control.
He was a difficult person.
Well, the jazz musicians didn't think so. They loved him and thought he was great and warm and charming. But people who were relying on him for something, whether it be editors waiting on deadline or his family waiting on family support, they were often left disappointed.
He had been wounded in the Pacific during World War II.
He was a combat photographer in the Pacific for 3 years, and in Okinawa in 1945, he was almost killed by a bomb.
And he left his family in Croton-on-Hudson when he moved into his loft on 6th Avenue. Why do you think he left everything behind?
Well, he was desperate. His ambitions had risen to levels that were unreachable. And he was, and that's not a good state of mind to be in if you want to be a family man. And it just wasn't a mix. I mean, even from a very early day in his marriage, he was writing letters to his wife saying, "I'm not who you need. I'm not the right man for you. I'm not the right husband. I'm not the right father for our kids."
He also had substance abuse problems. Was this something that predated his marriage?
Yes. Amphetamines were very popular back at mid-century. I mean, you could buy these things over the counter, and then psychiatrists were starting to experiment with different things, amphetamines, to battle depression. And Smith got hooked, and he also was an alcoholic. And so he had this cycle going of amphetamine and depressive alcohol. He would end up working for 4 or 5 days without stopping, and then he would just collapse in a heap of exhaustion.
His father had committed suicide.
His father committed suicide during the Great Depression.
How did the building become a hangout for jazz musicians?
That started before Smith moved in. It started in 1954 when a painter named David X. Young and a musician named Hall Overton and another musician named Dick Carey and a photographer named Harold Feinstein, those were the first four residents that lasted a period of time in this dilapidated building in a commercial district. It was not residential, which is important because this would have been shut down in a residential district by people complaining about noise in the middle of the night. It just sort of welled up with these men and living in this space and allowing musicians to come in. Musicians were always looking for a place with tuned pianos, and this building happened to have four tuned pianos.
So was most of it in Hall Overton's home?
Overton was on half of the fourth floor. David Young was on the fifth floor. Dick Carey was on the third floor. And the sessions, over the period of years, the residents changed. There were several others. A guy named Jimmy Stevenson was very important in the later years. And the sessions could be on any of the top three floors. But I would say that Overton was the real magnet. He was a revered figure.
In fact, he's famous for his arrangements for Thelonious Monk's big band sessions.
He also worked once a week for 2 years with the minimalist icon Steve Reich.
So he was really a serious composer who also worked as an arranger.
That's right, and he had this utter lack of need to promote himself or be acknowledged, and the musicians recognized that. So he had no ego, and so they felt really comfortable around him.
Was Eugene Smith a jazz fan? Because he was living in the middle of this.
Oh yes, when Smith died, he had 25,000 vinyl records, and classical and jazz were his favorites.
Because I'd imagine living there with musicians playing through the night might have been a little difficult. He was working on his Pittsburgh series. Did he abandon that because he became more interested in what was going on in his building?
Well, no, he abandoned Pittsburgh because his goals were unreachable. He had 2,000. He exposed 22,000 negatives in Pittsburgh, and 2,000 of which he said were his essay. And he went about trying to make finished master prints of those 2,000. But what are you going to do with 2,000 photographs? You can't exhibit them in any museum. You can't put them in any book. And so whatever he ended up doing was going to be a failure.
Well, you've written a book about his Pittsburgh project. Where are all these pictures now?
Well, his archive was established in 1978 at the University of Arizona, so all of his material is out there. And, yes, I came along. My wife is from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
So that's how you got involved, or did you get involved because you're interested in photography?
No, it was the city. I'm from the coastal plains of North Carolina, in a rural coastal town. And so Pittsburgh is about as different as you could see. And so the first time I went there, I was stunned by the city. I still am now, and I think it's one of the most important cities in America.
Well, it sure produced a lot of great jazz musicians.
It sure did.
There was no connection there as Gene Smith was concerned.
No. But I came along. I learned about Smith's Pittsburgh project in a camera shop in Raleigh, North Carolina in January of 1997. And from that day on, I've been studying his work. But it was the fact that he had this unfinished Pittsburgh opus that's what led me to him.
So he just abandoned it eventually and became totally involved with what was going on in the floors above and below him?
Yeah, he was really devastated by the outcome or lack thereof of his Pittsburgh project. And the photographer Robert Frank told me, who was a friend of Smith's, told me a few years ago that Gene went from a public journalist to a private artist in this loft. And with Life, what he did was he would go out into the world on an assignment and then report back to the coffee tables and barbershops and libraries and all across America. That's what he did with Life. He would report back with a photo story in the pages of Life magazine. But with this loft, what he did was much, much different. He didn't go anywhere. He just, with the same passion and fever that he devoted to his journalism, he started documenting the life right around him.
So he just walked around and kept on shooting what was going on?
That's right, and wiring the building. He drilled holes in the ceilings and the floors and walls of the building and wired it from the sidewalk to the fifth floor.
So he was also recording all of the stuff that took place there. And a lot of other photographers came to visit. You mentioned Robert Frank, one of the greatest photographers that ever lived. Cartier-Bresson also could make a claim for being the greatest photographer that ever lived. They came by because they were interested in what Smith was doing?
Yeah, and Deanne Arbus, there's a photograph of her.
Another great photographer.
Smith was a revered figure. He was much more revered then than he is now in the current trends and preferences of today's photo world. But back then he was one of the icons.
Now you've been working on this for 13 years. There is this book, The Jazz Loft Project: Photographs and Tapes of W. Eugene Smith from 821 6th Avenue, 1957-1965, published by Knopf. But you've also gotten involved in the audio aspects. Listeners to WNYC will be quite aware of this because Sarah Fischko has been doing a Jazz Loft Project radio series, which, by the way, can be accessed by going to our show page at WNYC.org. For you, was the photographs first and then the music?
Yeah.
Were you a jazz fan?
Yeah, I've been a jazz fan since 1991. And when I was working on the Pittsburgh project out in Smith's archive in 1998, I was in the back of the archive and I noticed a wall of cardboard boxes in the back of a photo archive. And all the archivists and curators are photography archivists and curators. So audio isn't what they're trained to do. And there was this, and I asked one day, what's in those cardboard boxes? And somebody said, those are the reels of tape that Gene Smith made in his loft building. And I said, I'm curious about that.
So this is opening up Pandora's box, isn't it?
So the next trip, I went out there. I scheduled a couple of extra days, and I picked through all of the reels of tape. There were 1,740 reels, and I noted 138 different names of jazz musicians that were written on the reels, and that's where the project started.
Well, some pretty great jazz musicians. I would have thought that these guys didn't need to come to late night sessions. Most of them were working full time.
Well, that's true, and a lot of the ones that were working full time were only there rarely, and I think that the story in some ways is about those who were not working full time, because the loft was a place where they could go and play, and then sometimes the great names would stop by on any given night.
Have you gone through all of the tapes by now?
Well, we spent about 5 years raising over $500,000 just to transfer the tapes to digital sources. And then once you have that, and that yielded 5,089 compact discs of material. So then we have to go through the process of listening to them and determining what's on them, because the labels are, sometimes they're not labeled, sometimes they're partially labeled. And we still have 1,500 CDs we haven't heard yet.
And in some cases, it's just people talking. It must be difficult to figure out who's talking sometimes.
It is difficult, especially considering the pitch on the tape sometimes can be slightly off, so somebody's voice can sound a little bit different. I have a colleague, Dan Partridge, who has been listening to these tapes full-time for 6.5 years, and he and I have learned to listen, to recognize voices. I want to point out that in many ways that is more interesting to us than the music. I mean, we're getting if these tapes were a group of people sitting around playing pool or throwing darts or playing cards in 1959 in the middle of Manhattan, these would be still important tapes.
Well, we mentioned some of the great musicians, but who else was coming to the Jazz Loft?
Well, it was an underground scene. I mean, there was drug activity there. We have some evidence of some kind of pimp prostitution type activity and thieves. I mean, the sometimes there wouldn't even be a door on the building down on the 6th Avenue on the sidewalk. Sometimes there was no door at all. It was just a cavern. And then other times there was a door that was unlocked, and thieves would come in and steal things.
And how did the musicians even know about these jam sessions?
Just word of mouth. I mean, the word got around quickly, especially because there were four tuned pianos in the building. So the piano players knew that they could go here almost any time and play a tuned piano.
Did everyone know that Eugene Smith had wired the whole place and put microphones everywhere?
Some people knew. Some people had no idea.
Because bootleg recordings probably would have upset Sonny Rollins or Charles Mingus or some of the other more famous musicians.
They probably would have. One of the things I point out is that Smith was part of his legend as a photographer is that he was so sensitive and compassionate to his subjects. And some people in today's photo world would even say he was too sensitive or too compassionate, and to the point of being sentimental. And if he had ever done anything with these tapes commercially, he would have been sensitive and compassionate to the subjects.
Are most of the discussions about music?
No. I mean, they can be about dive bars in the East Village or Upper East Side or somewhere or out in Queens. It can be about Staten Island. I mean, it can be about UFOs and the Cuban Missile Crisis. I mean, it's everything from that period.
You also learned about what was being broadcast on WMIC, because he would record stuff off the radio and he listened to this station.
Yeah, he did. He did.
Did you discover any connection or coherent theme among all of the conversations or broadcasts that he recorded?
Well, a lot of music, a lot of arts. He loved theater, so there's a conversation between Tennessee Williams and Yukio Mishima. I'm not sure that's known, but it might be. But
that's another book, I think.
Well, there's another book or project to be done just on what he recorded off radio and TV.
Mm. He, in the middle of all of this, he goes to Japan on assignment.
Yeah, he was desperate for money, and he always had a lifelong obsession with Japanese culture, starting, I think, when he was in combat as a combat photographer in World War II. And he got an assignment with Hitachi, the electronics company, to photograph their company village in Japan. It was very lucrative. And so he went there for a year.
Did the tape recorders continue going?
No, but there's one of the most intriguing tapes of all of them is the night before he left for Japan. And he had the tape rolling for about 8 hours. And you can hear him. What he's doing is he's securing the loft for thieves, because if he was going to be gone for a year, it'd be open season on his cameras and recording equipment. So he was locking the stuff up.
I'm amazed that the pianos weren't stolen.
Well, there were still musicians living in the building, and mm-hmm.
This is kind of like a commune, wasn't it?
It sort of was. I mean, everyone was paying a rent, but there would be people stop over. There'd be people who would squat in the loft for as long as 6 months.
You write in the book that March 1964 was a pretty significant time for the Jazz Loft. Why?
Well, help me. I can't remember what I said.
Well, this is before he moved out, wasn't it?
I'm not sure.
Uh-huh. Well, when did he move out? And
no,
what circumstances?
He moved out in 1971.
Mm-hmm. Around the time that the Jewish Museum held a retrospective of his work?
That's right. Yeah, it was right before he went to Japan again for his Minamata work, which became the greatest work of his career, and that was right after his epic show at the Jewish Museum.
The March 64 was when JFK was assassinated, and that's something that was documented here, wasn't it?
March of 64?
Yeah. I think it was. Anyway, I'm getting information from my staff. He was killed November 63, so I don't know what it is. But that was a question that was passed on to me, and I'm sorry.
No problem.
If I sound like a fool, but, you know, sometimes you just got to sound like a fool.
Well, live radio is hard.
Do we know why he moved out?
Well, he was basically evicted. He was preparing for this Jewish Museum show, and he was also preparing to leave for Minamata, Japan. He was more or less evicted.
Did he ever wind up reuniting with his family?
Well, yeah. He never left them totally. Every now and then, when he would come into money, he would make an extravagant gesture, like buy one of his kids a car. Their relationship with him was hard, and they were left wounded, but they knew. I mean, they were still tied to him, and still are today.
Because mm-hmm. he died of a stroke in 1978.
Yeah, he was 59 years old, but he had really just worn himself out. Photographs of him from the period make him look like he was 30 years older.
Because of all his drug abuse, yeah, and the other problems, and he had been wounded seriously at one point.
That's right.
And although he recovered, I'm sure it took a major toll on his body.
Right.
How did you wind up being the person who went through all of this material?
Well, it was an accident of history, really. It started with that Pittsburgh project in which I noticed the tapes. I noticed the tapes in 1998, and the University of Arizona had the rightful policy that the tapes could not be played until they were properly preserved. And so then we had to go about raising grants to preserve those tapes, and it took 5 years. We actually didn't hear a tape until late 2002. Hmm. With my passion for jazz and New York City, it became my work, my so-called career.
Only a few of the musicians who were at the Loft are still alive today. Have you gotten any feedback from them?
Yes, well, I've interviewed I started interviewing people in 1998 before I'd heard the tapes, and I've been to 19 states and interviewed 350 people. Mm-hmm. And we've documented about 600 people in this loft, and a lot of them have died since I interviewed them. And that's very meaningful to have gotten that down on tape.
Bill Evans, I'd imagine, Charles Mingus.
Yeah, they died a long time ago.
Well, Sonny Rollins and Roy Haynes are still around. And Ronnie Free, who also played there, he's going to be involved in some kind of performance.
Yeah, tonight at Barnes & Noble at Lincoln Triangle, I'm going to read from the book. And Ronnie Free, who is one of the most interesting figures in the entire story, he was basically the house drummer in the loft for a couple of years, 1959, 1960, and then just disappeared from New York overnight one night. He had a gig with Marion McPartland and didn't show up. And he didn't come back for 20, 30 years and really quit playing music, drove a cab and in San Diego, played beach volleyball in Charleston, South Carolina.
Did he tell you why he quit?
Well, that's a long story, but he had a lot of problems. And he basically left town in the middle of the night in order to save his life. But he's alive and well now. He plays drums in obscurity in the mountains of Virginia and plays with a working trio around Virginia, North Carolina, and sounds great. And he's playing with a very young band tonight at Barnes & Noble at Lincoln Triangle at 7:30.
This what makes this such an interesting story, beyond the fact that there are some wonderful photographs, it also documents an important time in the history of jazz, both visually and on audio tape.
Yeah, the scene in this period, with the tapes cover 1957 and 1964, and this was a period which was both the peak of jazz and the beginning of the decline in terms of being overtaken by folk music and rock and roll and R&B. You can actually follow that decline on the tapes. And in late 1964, and I thought this might have been the tape you were referring to, there's a wonderful tape where Zoot Sims is in the loft with Clarence Sharp, who's in C sharp, and some others, and you can hear them lamenting the lack of gigs. You know, there aren't as many gigs. The gigs that they are able to get aren't great. It's like Zoot was talking about. He had to play for a stripper. You know, it's just
Zoot Sims did.
Yeah, and he said it paid well, so I did it. But it's just the dignity of the scene was declining. It was being completely overtaken by rock and roll and folk and R&B.
Did any rock musicians ever show up?
No. The closest thing to a rock musician who showed up probably would be a piano player named Warren Bernhardt, who who plays with Steely Dan and some other bands.
Sam Stevenson's latest book, The Jazz Loft Project, Photographs and Tapes of W. Eugene Smith from 821 6th Avenue, 1957 to 1965, is published by Knopf. And you can find more information about Sarah Fischko's Jazz Loft Project radio series by going to our show page at WNYC.org. You can access the ones that have already been broadcast. I want to thank you so much for being with us
today. Thank you, Leonard. Thank you very much for having me.